This week on Writers, Inc.
The reality is that we are, amongst many things, the first major publisher built in the modern era of publishing. I'm the only female CEO of one of the top 10 publishers.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, I'm Christine Daigle.
A.P. Reinflush.
J. Kevin Tomlinson. Standing in, standing by.
Yeah, welcome to Writers, Inc.
Woo!
Welcome back, Christine. You were gone last week.
I was hooking up brains to computers last week, so...
Yeah. How'd that go? Are we doomed?
Yeah. No,
it
was,
over?
It
yeah.
was my favorite comment, and I'm not going to curse, but was one of the people I put it on, and she was operating YouTube with her brain, and she said, "This is some X-Men SHIT." And I was like, yeah. Yes, it is. That was my favorite comment. So awesome. I was training staff to be able to use it.
I learned today.
Yeah.
And you can confirm this or maybe debunk it, but I learned from one of the science YouTube channels that our brains are shrinking. Is that true?
I had no idea. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. So evolutionary shrinkage.
I mean, I would have to, why are they shrinking would be a question.
That's the question. That was the question they were asking. So what does that mean?
Because like brain power is not necessarily related to volume. So if you have a smaller brain, but it has more folds, it might actually be more efficient. So I don't know. Or maybe we're losing some volume for things we don't do anymore. Like
we no longer do.
Go outside. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
It'd be, you know, go outside.
We're losing the touch grass nerve centers of our brain.
Great. Yeah. So it's a reminder, go outside and touch some grass.
Yeah.
JD's out touching grass, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I don't know if he's touching
grass. He's in
grass,
Disney World.
He's in Disney
faux grass.
World.
Faux grass.
That's where faux grass. it sounds like a type of music that Christine's husband would be interested in.
Probably.
Faux grass music.
Yeah.
We should start that.
Yeah.
We should give that a start. I think
you go right ahead.
I like it. I don't know what it's gonna be, but I like it. What's faux grass?
Yeah. That's where I take a plastic fork, put it in between my teeth, and just twang it.
Yeah. Synthesizer banjo. I don't know.
right.
Anyway. Oh, I guess I should ask Kevin what's in the news.
Oh, well, let's get to the news. Okay. Well, first up. Relentless focus on literacy undermines reading for pleasure, says report. A new study shows a major drop in kids reading for fun, and researchers say an intense focus on measuring literacy skills is actually pushing enjoyment out of reading. There's a disconnect at home, too. Many parents say reading matters, but they prioritize learning outcomes over enjoyment, and more than half don't even cite fun as a reason they need to read to their kids. The fix is surprisingly simple. Make reading social and low pressure again. Reading out loud, usually using silly voices or treating books like shared experiences, because kids who are read to daily are 3 times more likely to read on their own.
Yeah.
They're shrinking brains.
Were you read to for fun as a kid?
I was never read to as a kid.
Aw.
No, I had to do all my own reading.
I was read to as a kid for fun. My dad used to read Lord of the Rings to me at night, which I don't know, when I was a little peanut.
Some of us didn't know our fathers, Christine.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It was The Hobbit. Then I read the Lord of the Rings on my own. But yeah, I got read.
What did you like better? Did you like The Hobbit better or Lord of the Rings better? And this is an academic question.
I don't know. Because like I got The Hobbit so young. Like it was a very different experience. But I enjoyed them all. I mean... Lord of the Rings had some very long battle scenes, which, you know, is a thing.
Yeah.
I enjoyed them. Yeah. I mean, that was really where I think my reading started. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got Rudyard Kipling too. I remember that now that I'm thinking about it. Just So Stories, How the Elephant Got His Trunk.
I don't have any memory of anyone reading to me, other than teachers. And
Yeah.
but as soon as I learned how to read, I was off to the races. So
Teachers are good. Did you get read to you for fun, JP? Do you remember this?
I don't remember if I was, so I'm
Oh.
not going to say no, just in case, someone hears and they're like, but you were, but I don't really remember. But I do know, like, the past like year or so, I'm trying to bring like fun back into reading because I feel like I was really like pushing for having to read every book that everyone recommends to me and feeling bad if I couldn't. So now I'm learning how to like DNF books and then do them. Like, I do it within like 2 days of an audiobook. I'm like, oh, I'm not vibing with this. We're done. And I move on. And it's so much better because when I find the books that I do vibe with, I'm reading them within like a day or two. Whereas it used to take me like weeks to get through a book that someone would recommend to me. And sometimes I would just not read for months because I was like, I can't get through this book. So I don't know. I think that reading for fun is super important because it trains the muscle and then you can spend the time reading for other purposes. But I think the enjoyment part is the most important part.
I agree with that.
People forget that, because all this comes from an oral tradition, and we, the way that knowledge and wisdom were passed down generationally was for someone to tell these stories and make them entertaining for the people listening. And so that it is a big part of our learning to engage that part of our brain. Maybe that's the part that's shrinking to leap back. But if a kid, if you're telling a kid a story and all it is lecture, they're not learning anything. They never will.
Or if it's like this academic thing you need for college, I'm gonna read you Herman
Yeah.
Melville's like what's that? Oh my God, why am I blanking on Ahab? Moby Dick or something. Like,
Moby Dick.
it may not
Yeah.
be the most fun experience if you're like reading to them for like SATs or whatever, because you know that's going to be on there. It's probably not too fun.
Yeah.
I don't know. But
Yeah.
yeah, I'm with you on that, JP, because I think as a writer, we fall into this trap because I was feeling for a while like I need to read every book in my genre that's coming out so I know it's there. Plus, these books that I should read in case people ask me about them. And it's not fun
Yeah,
sometimes.
no,
Sometimes
yeah.
it is, but sometimes it's not fun.
And two, like, just because a book isn't for you doesn't mean it's a bad book. And I think that was a big hurdle for me to try to understand was that, like, people can recommend bestsellers or I can see highly starred books and it will just not be for me. And that's okay. And then I can really enjoy a 3 or 2 star book. Because who cares? Like, I enjoyed it for a specific reason. And being able to catalog what those reasons are helps to then determine what I like as a reader and ideally how that translates to me as a writer.
I've actually been
Yeah.
having fun with that on Instagram just for my mental health, is finding some bestsellers and like try to guess the bestseller from the 1-star reviews on Goodreads. And some of them are just wild. And the books that they're like 1-starring and the things they say are hilarious. So that does
Yeah.
kind of help my writer mental health a bit. So.
All right. Next up, Indie Bookstore Day 2026. Over 2,000 US stores plus 200 in Canada participated in Indie Bookstore Day 2026, with many reporting record-breaking sales that rivaled Christmas-level traffic. What's driving the success is community and experience. Bookstore crawls, author events, karaoke fundraisers, kids' activities, and even hidden golden tickets for audiobooks are turning bookstores into social destinations, not just retail spaces. Indie stores are also collaborating instead of competing, teaming up with other shops, local businesses, and even civic groups, proving that local community-driven book culture is becoming a powerful counterforce to online retail.
I saw in my community they did a bookstore crawl, so like all five bookstores, and they were doing this golden ticket thing for the audiobooks, like win 12 audiobooks. It was very cool.
Yeah, our area did the bookstore crawl a couple of years now, and then this past year they kind of broke things up and they one of them did a crawl for a cause. So they had some local charity and then they included other locations that weren't just bookstores. And then the idea was that you'd kind of go to each and you'd patron each, and then the proceeds, a percentage of it, would then go to some type of charity or cause in the area.
That's fun.
Yeah. I really like this. I think that, like, the indie bookstore market, especially in this area, seems to be doing really well. And I think that it brings, like, a good vibe to the area. People seem really engaged. They go to a lot of the events that they host. And two, like, it just seems like such a really good hub for community. So I'm really glad to see that, like, these indie bookstores are going well.
Yeah. I saw an article that came out today that said there's a 70% increase in bookstores. Like, they're on the decline. Oh, wow. Now they're really rising again as people are wanting to go more analog, which is amazing. I love it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say within the past, like, 5 years, I've seen four bookstores in the area that I can drive to within like 20 minutes that have popped up.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where I am currently, there's maybe a couple of independent bookstores, and they're okay. They're not, I feel kind of bad for them because maybe they do great in their tiny little market, but they don't offer much. There's not a lot of draw, and I've never been in any of them where there was more than maybe one other person in the store that didn't work there. But I'm hoping that they, you know, these things catch on and, you know, support your local bookstores. On that note, though, like, I'm shocked at the number of times I've gone into an indie bookstore and introduced myself and was told to my face that they won't stock independent authors.
Yeah.
Like, okay, support your local indie bookstore, but, you know, screw those authors who are out there trying to get by.
Well, I don't know. My local bookstores have been awesome. They've stocked.
Yeah.
So I can't.
Some are.
I can't complain.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that totally depends on the store and also, like, the relationship with the store. I know, like, one of ours wants sort of like a back and forth. They want you to attend the events that they have and ideally patron them before they really consider you in their like stock. But I think regardless of that, there's such like a good ability to have socials back and forth. So I don't know why bookstores, you know, that you have that experience where bookstores don't want that, because now you can post about their bookstore if you're in there, and you know, they can post about you. So, like, it just seems like a silly thing to just cut off the authors that are in the area.
Yeah. All right. Final story. The Small Press View. After leaving a major publisher, Jim Hannes lost access to expensive industry data like BookScan, and needed a way to recreate a clear, accessible view of what's actually happening in the small press market using free public data. He created a free data dashboard that tracks how books from around 900 small and indie presses are performing, especially by pulling daily Amazon rankings for titles in the top 50,000. It also combines multiple industry signals in one place, including the independent press top 40, bestseller list, and upcoming titles from Edelweiss and NetGalley, so you can see trends, comps, and what's coming next. The goal is to give authors, agents, and publishers a, quote, small press view of the market, helping them discover books, analyze what's working, and make smarter decisions without needing expensive tools like BookScan. I support this whole idea. I'm going to have to go check this out. I think
this is pretty cool for indie authors to have that information, like, what's the word? Is coalesce the word? I don't know. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
All in one place.
Conglomerated or collated.
Thank you. That was the word I was looking
globbed.
For. Globbed.
Globbed.
Globbed. Gooped together.
Gooped together. Jammed.
In the link.
Inserted.
That was a DS9 reference. The great link.
In the link. Yeah. Hey, I've been watching a lot of DS9 lately, by the way. So, I'm all for things like this. We've had something similar to this in the past, and it got, shall we say, corrupted. I won't go into the details, but there was someone who was tracking all this and doing an industry report, and it was very useful to have. And then, you know, then things like data marketing and all that stuff started happening. I don't necessarily think any of that's wrong. I just think that you need to be upfront about what you're doing with this stuff to begin with. But anyway, It's always good to have Data.
It's good. Data's good.
At least they thought so on Star Trek.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for the news.
Ah, who's up this week, Kevin?
Well, this week we got a special one. We're talking to Dominique Rocha. She's the founder, CEO, and publisher for Sourcebooks, which has gone from its indie roots to being one of the top five publishing houses. We're chatting about the origins of Sourcebooks and how she turned it into such a powerhouse. Here is Dominique Rocha. So first up, I think some people may not actually surprisingly be familiar with Sourcebooks. Do you want to kind of give us a rundown of what Sourcebooks is and where you guys got started?
Sure. I started Sourcebooks in my bedroom, and I've been doing it for some time, and we've grown into the fifth largest publisher in the country. We are the non-traditional publisher. We are the first, I mean, the reality is that we are amongst many things, the first major publisher built in the modern era of publishing. I'm the only female CEO of one of the major top 10 publishers. There's a lot that's really distinct and different because Sourcebooks was built by an entrepreneur, right? Like, so,
right.
So that just, everything is different. We're one of the, I think, it was kind of cool. I was talking to Harvard Business School, did a case study about Sourcebooks, and it was the first case study in books they've done in 17 years. And the woman, the professor who did it, said, you are the most deeply disruptive force in book publishing. So I think, I don't know that I would say that about us, but I will say to you, we are very distinct from anything else that looks to you like a traditional book publisher.
And what do you think the formula is there? Like, what is it that makes Sourcebooks distinct? Because you guys really are standing out. You're currently, well, what are you, in the top five, right?
Yeah, we're top five.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, especially considering
your first,
origins.
We're the first people to get into the top five in the modern age. So what's interesting about that is, and this is just me being interested.
No, that's fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that literally people believed it could not be done. Like literally that is a belief that people have, that you cannot break into the top five. So that's been kind of fun. The formula is I think three things, to the extent that there is one, by the way. The first I would say is mission. We are true believers. Like the most important thing I can talk to you about is that books change lives. And yeah. I can talk about that all day long, and I can talk to that about that with every one of my authors, and they all have different missions and different visions and different, and I love that about each and every one of them. So first, mission. The second is I'm an ex-mathematician. So data, it's our DNA, which is really different from I would say everyone else, because for everyone else in our ecosystem, data has sort of been grafted onto the organization.
Right.
For us, data has been sort of an essential part of the organizational structure, right? And as a result, innovation is how we actually work. Like, it's not like, oh yeah, we've got an innovation team over there. It's like every single time that we're working on something, we're like, oh, what would make that more interesting? How would we do that differently?
Yeah.
And then the third thing, which I think in some ways is the most important, is mindset. So when we, and which I think you and I are going to end up talking about a fair amount, because I think mindset is actually the thing that makes entrepreneurs entrepreneurs. It's what makes indie authors indie authors. It's what, right? And so growth mindset has been, I started on that path about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. It's been really eye-opening for our people and for me, and it has changed completely how I think about leading in this time.
Yeah. I want to say, by the way, that you started, no one heard this because it had to get cut, but you told me you were boring, and now I'm like, you just dropped like three bombs on me right away about your philosophy and how you guys got started. And the fact that you were a mathematician, what in the world prompted you to get into books as a mathematician?
So I really am. Like I was Ledyard Tucker's last graduate student. So I'm a like deeply geeky human being, deeply geeky. I married a scientist who has, I don't know, 35 or 40 patents. So I mean, like yeah. I, you know, and my dad was a physicist. So like I'm I, and my you know, so I'm kind of a family of geeks. I think in a way people lean into, and I suspect this is true of you as well, people lean into the thing that has the heart for them, right? Yeah. Like the thing that it's not about your head. It's about kind of the thing that is really speaking to your heart.
Right.
I think books really revolutionized who I became as a human being. You know, if you think about books, we are all of us deeply isolated, right? Yeah. Like as human beings, we're little packages, right? And we're closed off from one another. We rarely actually connect. And if you think about books, it's one of the few times that you let somebody else's voice into your head.
Yeah.
And
in a healthy way, anyway.
In a really
There's always way. Social media.
Like social media, you know what? I actually have largely like I've gotten off. Just like
yeah,
it's like,
I don't
oh,
blame
yeah,
you.
This is not good for my head. So I found books to be extraordinarily useful and revelatory, and they changed who I became as a human being, and I wanted to find a way to be part of that community, which, by the way, that community does not let people in very easily.
That's true. Yeah. We are guarded against strangers. We are guarded against the other, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What did you do to soften that barrier? How did you get past that?
You really don't. What happens is that you know, we kept building, right? And so, you know, there was a point in which we were like the 18th largest publisher in the country. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Then, you know, you kind of build and build and build. And you know, today, a friend of mine who's very well known in the field said, Dom, you can't say you're the other anymore. Like, you just can't say that anymore. Like,
you know, not if you're going to be in the top five.
Yeah, right. He was like, that's just not possible to talk about that way. So I think at some, but their truth is, I mean, there is a truth that is amongst the most insular part of our community, we are still, Sourcebooks is very much an outsider.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that's what's giving you such an advantage?
Yeah, I think, but being both an insider and an outsider has some play, right? I also think being located in Chicago, it's a huge asset, huge asset. I think it's hard to be in the New York community. I think you find that you speak to the same people over and over again, and you have many conversations that can be very similar, and being outside. outside of that community can be a real advantage.
Yeah, you've mentioned being an insider and an outsider, and I think that's how a lot of writers feel. So
Yeah.
that may be why people are resonating.
Well, look, I am really deeply connected to writers. I think
Yeah.
that's probably where my personal passion lies.
Me too. Me too. I've given up more of my personal time for the writing community, I think, than any other living soul.
That sounds
So,
exciting.
yeah, it's really not. So you, I had a, there was a question that one of the co-hosts asked as a kind of joke, but I think it's a good question. And that is, did you guys outsell Macmillan last year? Because they sure seemed ticked off.
We were, and this year it's continuing this year.
Yeah.
We are, and you know, there is a world in which we continue. I mean, we're continuing to build.
Right.
You know, I can't talk about it right now, but I'm going to tell you, we're going to announce four imprints in the next, amount of
Oh,
time.
wow.
And two of them you're going to care a lot about,
Yeah.
they will, people will notice. So two of them people will sit, will not notice at all, but two of them people will notice. And I care about all four, by the way. So it matters. I don't pay a whole lot of attention to whether we're bigger than this one or smaller than that one.
Right.
I care a lot about what are we contributing and what's the value we're adding and can we make a difference? Like it's that kind of stuff that seems
Yeah.
to matter to the Sourcebooks team and the Sourcebooks community.
You're starting more imprints. You guys already have several. You know,
We have
that's
21 imprints, either 20,
yeah.
yeah, I think we have 21 imprints and we're adding four.
I can't even imagine looking at the list. I don't even know what the other four could possibly be. It's
They're really
I can't wait
cool.
to hear. We'll
Really
talk.
cool.
We'll talk after the show. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, I one of the questions I have is, I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys started as a your approach was more about the indie author space, right? Isn't that kind of your origins, the genetics of this? Yeah.
I wrote the first book.
Yeah.
It was terrible. It was just terrible.
Ah.
Oh my God. See, I mean, you're writing fiction.
Yeah.
I did such a horrible book. Todd has a copy of it. It's so ugly too. It's like one of the ugly, it is probably the single ugliest book maybe ever created, like in the
Wow.
history of mankind. Like it could look like that,
So
right?
what you're saying is I got to get my hands on this book.
No.
So
It's like too much, too much.
Yeah.
But it, no, please don't link to it, Audrey. Thank you. Yeah, I started actually, there was a book that there was a book. See, everything in my life changed because of books.
Everything started with a book. That's
Everything
a
started
great.
with a book. So there was a book that actually outlined all the ways to make a self-published book. Okay, which today we would do as an ebook, but at that time was not an ebook. It
Yeah.
was a physical book. And I followed it. I remember following it, buying a copy and following it step by step. So paragraph, like you buy an ISBN, you have to get it from over here. You like write every list. Like I followed every single list. That's kind of what I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I did the same thing. I mean, I
Yeah,
think I
you did.
actually downloaded Mark Coker's book from Smashwords when they were.
Smashwords. I know Mark. Yeah, you bet.
Yeah. That's interesting. Do you think that that indie mindset is still part of the is that 'cause I see the industry, the trad pub industry, shifting more towards the indie model, using a lot of our tactics. And I mean, I've been approached by people in the traditional world to kind of consult on that kind of thing. Do you think that, you know, is that part still part of your DNA? Is that the edge?
Yeah, I think that,
Yeah.
look, being entrepreneurs,
Yeah.
it's different, right? Like Kevin, you've experienced it as different. I'm willing to bet people on the call who are going to listen to this are also going to experience it as different. Being entrepreneurial looks like asking questions, finding out about, oh, would this thing help me over here? This guy's got a new model. Should we try that? You know, like, right? And that really is different than the trad world, where the trad world has not really seen much of a shift, right? Like they're used to their world being a very, very process-based, right? Like it goes like this. Our world is much more fluid. It's much more, in some ways, interesting, I would say. Much more dynamic, right?
I've always said that we're all just a bunch of entrepreneurs, throwing together books. Well, most of us wrote books. I think a big chunk of the indie author community became authors so that they had something to sell, something to produce. So you talked about mindset. Let's get into that, because I do think that's vital. And I've had some trouble with mindset here and there throughout my career. So, when you talk about mindset, what are you talking about?
There's a woman who's, I'm not kidding, like I'm gonna reference a lot of books, and that
You
not, I
got
mean, most of them are not mine. Okay. So
Okay.
there's a woman named Carol Dweck who did a book called
Yeah.
Mindset, in fact,
Yes.
right? And she
Big
talks
fan of
about,
that book.
yeah, exactly. So, but I think it was 10 years ago, I read that book and got into growth mindset, as she calls it. It changed, I think, everything for me. Primarily because creating a culture which is learning oriented, as opposed to a culture that thinks it knows the answer, those are very distinct cultures. And when, you know, there was a point at which we were a very small team of people, right? 10, 15 people. Today, Sourcebooks is 350 people, right? So making sure that you create an environment in which people are thriving and learning and continuing to grow, that's, you know, that's, I think, a lot of what my job looks like.
And authors need that. They need people to encourage them in growth, because we tend to kind of sink in on ourselves, and we'll kind of pull back, and a lot of us are afraid to promote ourselves. There's all these things. We put up all these barriers. Do you find that with your author base? Are they kind
Yeah,
of,
and
they
I
need
think
that
also,
nudge?
well, I would not call it nudge. I think authors need fans. And I would say I'm the number one fan for a lot of my authors. Like so there are authors who I think there are authors who do in fact pull in and periodically you want to just make sure that they hear how incredible what they're doing is, and how you get that, how hard it is to have that blank page in front of you, and how much we who are your readers and your fans admire the courage that it takes to write that page, right? Like that's kind of how I see part of what I'm doing.
It's kind of like constantly jumping out of an airplane, uncertain whether you're wearing a parachute or a knapsack.
Right, exactly. It is for, you know, I have authors, God help us, who read reviews. And just, okay, so I'm just going to be the person who says, I'm not sure authors should read all of their reviews. I just be the person who says that to you. And that can be really hard for people, you know, that can be really devastating for, you know, and I remember an author saying to me, I wrote this book this way, and this person read it and they took it this way. And I was like, yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's true.
Those can slap though. I mean, early in my career, I had someone write a review saying they thought I was better at talking about writing than actually writing, and it was a good solid month before I could face the keyboard again. So, but then I won an award for the book that he was criticizing. So, I guess it all washed out.
You know, I think, look, they're not all books are going to be for every reader.
Right.
Okay. Kevin, not every book that you write will be for every reader in the universe. Okay. And we should just work on finding the reader.
That's right.
That will love your book. And my job is to help find those readers. That's the job I think we as a publishing organization have.
So on that note, then, what's the, like, how are you guys approaching that? We'll just keep it top level as a philosophy first. Like, you know, what's the philosophy that drives finding the right reader for the right book, the right author?
Look, I think that today discovery is we really understand some things about how the book discovery process works for people.
Yeah.
And we can, like, kind of like an onion, we can unpeel a bunch of things to help you find the right reader. We can say this kind of book belongs in airport stores. This kind of book does not. Yeah. This kind of book should be at a Barnes & Noble. This kind of book probably not. This yeah. kind of book belongs with, you know, the Walmart buyer who has this kind of a on this particular promotion. And then obviously for ebooks, there's an even more specific kind of process. And for online, there's another even more specific kind of process. There is really a tremendous amount that we can create for our authors today. And I think we are now seeing that fandom is an international opportunity. Fandom is an internet. I've taken authors to number one around the world now. And I am so excited about that.
Yeah. By the way, all of that right there is already, I think, something that differentiates you from the other four in your category. The fact that you're even considering things like this market is better for this book than these other markets. I mean, we're going to put our energy there. I think most of the rest of your ilk, we'll say, tend to think in terms of like, how do we get this book to go number one in all these different places? You know, I want it, you know, on the shelves in Barnes and Noble, and I want it number one on Amazon, and I want it number one here and there. So to me, that's a big differentiator.
And Kevin, the other thing that I start with, and I start with this for every author, is what does the author actually want? Because one of the things that's really, like, I've learned from many years of being a fan across a whole lot of different authors, right? Is you might hear, for example, there's an author who will sit across from me and say, you know what, Dominique, what I really want is I want to be number one New York Times. It's like, okay, great. I can create a plan that gets you there. Okay. Yeah. Or an author might say, you know what I really want? Like I heard this from one of my very favorite authors. I want to change the way the world thinks about this and create this level of connection around the world. I'm like, okay, great, got it. I mean, I know exactly what my marching orders are. I know what the plan that needs to go down looks like, right?
Yeah.
So we work bespoke for so first we understand this is also a very, very distinct. We understand that we work for authors.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And we also understand that what we're doing is creating what they would like to accomplish. And, right. and that will look different depending on who the author is.
Yeah. That's I love it anytime anyone can legitimately work the word bespoke into a conversation. So congratulations on that. I mean, we're kind of coming up on time, so we probably better wrap things up, but what do you think? I mean, going forward, I know you can't reveal any specifics right now until I hit stop on the record, button, of course. But going forward, what's the objective? What are you guys aiming for?
Look, I want to change the world. I think the world sucks and needs to be changed, right? Like, I don't think it's a great world that we're living in right now. And so I'm really interested in creating a world of readers. And some of the stuff that you're going to see me do, some of the imprints that we're doing are all about, you know, expanding readership, creating readership at different levels and for different ages. I think we can do better. I think we can do more.
Yeah. I like the philosophy of changing the world through books, believe me. And this is, I have my own personal mission statements around that kind of thing. So that resonates with me. So I'm glad you guys are out
there. Yeah, I work with like a ton of people who are like-minded, right? So I'm very lucky that way. I have like a really amazing role and job that way.
Yeah.
You know, so I get to work with some extraordinary people, including someone in their category. So I'm very, very lucky.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us, Dominique. I appreciate you being here. I'm sure there's a million questions I should have asked that I didn't ask, but you were far from the most boring person. So thank you for being on the show.
Okay, so I was not the most boring person.
Not the most boring.
330 episodes. Not the most boring person you've ever had on, right?
You do not get that particular prize. Well, maybe next time.
I feel good about that.
All right. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
Okay. So this was a great conversation. Not for the least reason that she actually bought one of my books, immediately before.
Oh,
so I need
cool.
to check in and see what she thought. I haven't gotten any like, hey, we want to represent you calls or we want to publish you calls.
Not so yet. As Carol Dweck would say, you haven't
that's
gotten
true.
Any calls.
I got to have that positive mindset.
Growth mindset.
So if we talked about authors essentially being entrepreneurs, how should that change the way authors approach writing? Like should craft decisions be influenced by business thinking, or should those remain completely separate?
I feel like this is a JP question.
A JP question? I was going to say JP a JD question. Yeah, well, no, go ahead, JP.
I mean, I would argue that it depends if you want to or when you're ready to shift into the entrepreneurial mindset. You probably need to consider how your products are being interpreted by the public. And a key point of doing that is making sure that you are giving people what they expect. And that's more than just like, if you're an author and you're writing in a genre, it's the same but different method, right? Or it's the look at the tropes that are popular. How can you put your spin on it? And so there is like, I'm not going to say it's a requirement, but it is something along the lines of one needs to make sure that you are aware of the market around you so that you can stand out, but you can also be what people are expecting of that and not just like, oh, I'm going to pick up this, you know, horror and it turns out to be a romance and, you know, that sort of thing. That's super important, especially when you shift over into the entrepreneurial side of things.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I would argue.
I do think that if one of your goals is to make any form of living from this and any sort of income from this at a greater than paid hobby level, then from the very start, you should be thinking about things like your target market, your marketing strategy, like where, you know, what there's overhead. As much as I like the idea of being able to publish freely with no real overhead, but there are expenses and overhead that are involved with this, and you might absorb those if it's just a hobby. But if your goal is to make money, then you need to be considering like, where am I investing this stuff and what's the best investment? Because things like cover design, you know, having a really cool looking cover is fine, but that's not actually the right approach. You want a cover that will invoke the genre that you're in and will, you know, look the same but different in comparison to other titles. So you need somebody who's skilled at, what I call cover psychology. You need, there's copywriting considerations. There's all these things. It doesn't matter if you're just publishing because you want to have a published book. If you want.
My cover for Mandrake Manor, when it first came out, I got a local illustrator, and I really love that cover because I think that it's like a really fun interpretation of the book. But it was out for a year and it just didn't sell in the way that I thought it would. So I swapped and I got a cover from someone who works in the genre, and it became a very different style. And like that book is basically the reason why I'm a full-time author. So like the big difference of doing a cover that actually fits the market versus something that you think could fit the market, but you're not the person that knows the genre well enough as a designer who is doing that research. That was just a big, huge difference. And it's just the same book, but a different cover.
The important part is that I have the original cover, and one day we'll sell it for $1 million because
Hell
there's like
yeah.
a very small print run.
Well, and see, and the thing is, like, that is now, it's a special edition kind of version of it. You could still have that out there as a collector's
No,
cover,
only
and you can
me.
offer that art. Only Christine can have it.
Only you.
Only me.
All right, so the idea of being both an insider and outsider came up as a strategic advantage, and I like that thinking as someone who is often an outsider. So how can writers deliberately position themselves as outsiders in a way that strengthens their voice instead of just isolating their career?
I guess it depends what you mean. Like, I know JD's always trying to think outside of the box and of what he's doing, that's not being done. I still think we need to do an escape room as our next publicity for a book. But yeah, I think like doing things that maybe in a different way, or I think that's cool.
Yeah, JD's got the right attitude for all of it. I've always thought, like, he looks at what everyone else is doing, and he kind of runs in the opposite direction, because there's only so many, like, everyone always goes to the same go-tos, right? I'm gonna print up some bookmarks. I'm gonna, postcards.
Postcards. And like everyone's still on all the forums I'm on, they're like, oh, you have to sell your booksellers postcards. Your
Yeah,
booksellers do not want postcards.
they do
Like,
not want your
they do not
postcards.
want
Take
them.
it from somebody who spent the early years spending lots and lots of money on postcards that just ended up round filed and thrown away.
I think part of it is knowing your brand and then leaning into that as heavy as you can. So like my early brand was like dark, strange, and queer. So I could figure out what colors, that sort of thing to make me stick out in the genre that I'm writing. Now it's more of that like cozy, strange, and queer. But like I know how I fit mostly within the cozy fantasy universe. And I know how I can make my voice sort of stick out and what I'm doing that's slightly different than other people. Based off of like, some people will do Substack, I do Twitch and those sorts of things so that I can try and reach a broader, different audience. I guess that would be it, is like just figuring out who you represent, who you are, what your brand is, would be like a really big, important thing for me.
Absolutely.
Let's ask one last question here, because we talked about, so Dominique framed everything as she framed the publisher's role as finding the right reader, not convincing everyone to buy the book. So what would you change, or what would change if all writers fully embraced that idea that the book isn't for everyone?
Ooh, that is a good question. 'Cause yeah, you're right. There are those books that are Walmart books, and then, there are those books that are more niche books that would be better in an indie store and being hand-selled or, at certain conventions. So I think you really have to take a look at what you're writing. Like maybe you are writing that Walmart bestseller, thriller, but maybe you're writing, I don't know, cozy sci-fi that would be better at a certain kind of shop or a convention to get that kind of organic. sales. So yeah, I really think you have to be honest with yourself on who is my ideal reader and where do I find them? Because your book is not for everybody. And I think that's as soon as you realize that, like whenever I'm talking about my book, I'm like, do you like, dark thrillers that are a little, disturbing and serial killer? Because if you don't, that's okay. You don't have to read this book because you won't like it, right? Like if you want to read a cozy fantasy, my book is not for you. It's they're not the same readers usually. I mean, there are always those, exceptions that read all over the place in all the genres, but a lot of people just like to stick to their same genres, which is fine.
It was a little easier for me to recognize that my books aren't for everyone because one of the factors of my books is queer, and queer is just inherently like you're either gonna like it or you're gonna hate it. There's clear barriers to some people who will not read that kind of stuff anyway. And I just know that exists. And that, like, having that identity thing, it's a non-negotiable. Now, when you sort of expand that into like cozy sci-fi, you're definitely not going to grab the military sci-fi. And you have to come to realize that that's just not going to happen. Yes, there is the crossover readers, but if you have a diehard military sci-fi fan and you're writing sci-fi military or sci-fi fantasy or whatever, that you're just not going to have that crossover. And so trying to placate to them is going to water down your book and what you're trying to tell. And so you should always focus on what is the story you're trying to tell, what is the topics, the tropes that you're pulling from, that you're twisting and subverting, but stop trying to placate to the other ones that are around it and really hone in on what that specific core essence is that you're writing.
I guess this kind of loops back to all the things, the outsider thing, the business thing, but I have always approached my career as what I'm actually out there peddling, selling, marketing is the Kevin Tomlinson brand. Because when I my favorite books were always accompanied by my favorite authors. Like if I fell in love with an author, I read everything that that person wrote, and I wanted readers like that. So all my entire strategy, everything I've done, has been about building an audience of people who would read. Read the phone book if my name was in it, right? So that when you take that approach, it you really finding the and it's actually a little easier, I think. I mean, it's been slower growth, in that I haven't had a mega bestseller that caused the whole world to beat a path to my door yet. But
Yet,
what I
Carol Dweck.
have had,
Yet.
see the Carol Dweck, I'm kicking it in. What I have had is a lot of readers who were so enthusiastic about my stuff that they went and told their family and their friends, and
Yeah, that's what you want, right? Those super
that's
fans
what
want to
I want.
spread the word. Yeah, cool. All
And I
right.
just need those people to buy $100,000 worth of books each. That's
Exactly.
all I really
That's all.
need.
Just mortgage your house. That's fine.
Who we got coming up next week, Christine?
Next week, we have Chris M. Barkley. Chris is a fan writer, journalist, and activist from Cincinnati, Ohio. He has been active in sci-fi fandom for 50 years and has attended over 200 conventions, 35 world science fiction conventions. I think it's really cool because we've never had a fan writer on before. I'm really excited to hear about this. He also writes for File 770, a column called So Glad You Didn't Ask, a column of unsolicited opinions. And he was the 2023 recipient of the Hugo Award for Best Fan Writer at the World Sci-Fi Convention in China and nominated again in 2025 for Best Related Work. So, fan writing we got coming up next week with Chris M. Barkley. It's going to be great.
Sounds like a good time. I'm
Yeah.
here. I'm here for it.
If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.